the students are fascinated to see that someone who ordinarily they know behind the couch can be on the stand and try to influence social justice and influence foster care systems, influence schools, churches, and often corporations.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking not only to their offices, but also off the couch in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully the worst is over and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Gilbert Kleiman. Dr. Kleiman is actively involved in the Harlem Family Institute, the Harlem Psychoanalytic Institute. And in this conversation, he gives examples of the kind of work he's doing, especially giving voice to the voiceless, giving voice to those who suffer, who are traumatized, often in silence and often ignored. And for me, this conversation isn't simply about, he's 92 years old, isn't simply about his being an elder and looking back on our field. It's about a man who is vibrantly alive, passionately interested in furthering his thinking, his contributions, teaching others, in essence, his legacy. He has won all the awards one could win. He's won the Anna Freud Award, the Humanitarian Award of the American Psychoanalytic Association, the Rieger Award. He's been on all the boards and all the panels. He's done all that. But what remains is this creative mind. And I found it a real pleasure and satisfaction to this being my second interview with Gil. And I hope you find it as meaningful and inspiring as I did. Here's my conversation with Dr. Gil Kleiman. Gil, welcome to the podcast. It's so nice to have you back again. You and I first spoke in March 2020, it was episode number 39. It was before the lockdown. And at that time, I just had an occasion to listen to it again. And I really enjoyed hearing it, actually. You and I spoke about reflective network therapy, RNT, which is the program that you came up with that's being used widely in schools, in classrooms. And the net of it is that kids who go through the program end up with dramatic cognitive improvements. And you and I do a fairly deep dive on it. And for those who are interested in pursuing that, I recommend that conversation. Since then, since a year and a half ago, I've spoken with Catherine McCormick, who uses RNT in her work with the Tulalip tribe in their school system with good results. I've also had a conversation with Jenny Davids in London, with whom you worked to put together a COVID workbook for kids in South Africa. So indirectly, I've been following you for the past year and a half. And then, not long ago, you sent an email out on the American Psychoanalytic Association listserv, and it really touched me. It was an email on the occasion of your 92nd birthday, and you were looking to both give and receive a birthday present. That is, the gift you wanted to give was to invite people to learn about and potentially train in one of your new projects at the Harlem Family Institute, which we're going to discuss. And the gift you hoped to get was a sense of satisfaction to see your legacy being carried forward. And that brought to mind, maybe you and I should check in again and have another conversation, which is why we're here. And there's much to discuss. There's the Harlem Family Institute. There's your work on post-traumatic stress disorder. And there's also for you to share with us what it's like being an elder in our field, what it's like for you looking back on the many decades that you've been involved, both in child psychiatry and analysis, and what the field has transformed itself before your eyes, what you think is good about it, what you think needs to be kept an eye on, what you hope the future is, much to reflect. But how about if you start us off by telling us about this new project of yours, the Harlem Family Institute?
Well, it is a treat to talk with you. You're an excellent converser, and you evoke a lot of thought in a compassionate way. I think your work is very constructive. I would like to correct your idea that the Harlem Psychoanalytic Institute is in any way my project.
Okay.
I am the chairman of the Harlem Family Institute and its Harlem Psychoanalytic Institute. But that program is 30 years old.
Oh my, I didn't know that at all. And I suspect that's not unusual not to know that. That's right.
It's very little appreciated that an African-American pediatrician and child analyst, Mary Morgan Lawrence, started that psychoanalytic institute amongst other founders. And it has been going a long time and trained, I think, over 90 psychoanalysts, mainly persons of color or from oppressed minorities. I found, as I look back on quite a few decades of psychoanalytic experience, that psychoanalytic organizations were quite Eurocentric and very white. They don't train African-American or Latino or oppressed minority people very often. It reminds me of when I went to medical school. There were overt quotas then for Jewish people, and very few African-American people were in Harvard Medical School. There were two in my class of 100. So I was delighted when I was asked if I would join the Scientific Advisory Council of the Harlem Psychoanalytic Institute. David Abrams, a very seasoned psychologist and psychoanalyst, had been trained at a psychoanalytic program I informally but successfully started at the Center for Preventive Psychiatry beginning around 1965. And he knew my work and had written about my work concerning IQ gains amongst preschool children. He wanted me on their scientific council, and I accepted with pleasure and started talking occasionally about what I thought were opportunities at Harlem in the psychoanalytic training program. Amongst those opportunities, I saw that there could be a very useful special education program for disturbed preschoolers and traumatized preschoolers in Harlem, based upon a reflective network therapy model. I obtained a $100,000 grant for funding that service, and we're waiting to have it matched so we can begin. In addition to being on the scientific council, I was asked would I consider being chairman of the board of directors. I responded by saying, I'm too white, old, and Jewish. You need to have an African American or Latino chairperson to be the face of your organization. But they insisted. They twisted my arm. My super ego pained me to say no. And I finally said yes. And so I've been the chairperson most of a year now. And in that process, I found some very interesting things, which are very much like the history of psychoanalysis, as I know it. And that the interesting things is that the elders, with the possible exception of myself, were garrulous and querulous, quarrelsome, and loved loudly debating each other at the expense of the candidate's intellectual development. Now, I was able to make some changes. I found the elders really appreciated being noticed, and I was able to help them modulate what sometimes was a level of argument that approached screaming at each other. It reminded me very much of the American Psychoanalytic Institute online list, where people scream and even defame each other. I know it all too well because my wife was president and was often the target of American psychoanalytic members screaming and being garrulous and querulous. Well, to my great pleasure, the Harlem Family Institute and its Psychoanalytic Institute have become a home for my legacy. I'm in the middle now of conducting two series of seminars, which are well attended from all over the nation and somewhat from outside the nation. And those seminars concern what I think of as my legacy. Forensic contributions, where psychoanalysts evaluates, gives opinions, and speaks in court on behalf, often, of a highly traumatized person seeking compensation for psychological damages. I'll come back to that in connection with my unifying theory of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yes.
But the other seminar I'm giving is on reflective network therapy. So altogether, I'm training people in things I think I couldn't easily pass on unless I have some successors and students who take the work seriously and study it microscopically. For example, we have had the opportunity given by a federal court, to hear me as a psychoanalyst actually on the stand live in a federal circuit court trial. My students were able to listen not only to my direct testimony, but also to the cross-examination I had to endure, as experts do in court. I don't know of any other opportunity that students have had to actually hear their instructor at work in a real-life situation, a phrase, real-life situation, which characterizes a lot of my other work. I also like to show all the warts and the assets I bring to bear as a psychoanalyst by showing videotapes of my actual interviews of psychologically damaged people who are coming to court. And my students thus learn how to give a voice to often very voiceless people. Even sometimes nonverbal children are able to gain a voice. And the students have accompanied me through video and recordings into record-making verdicts on behalf of nonverbal children who have been able to tell me with sign language or with the help of a caregiver the terrible things that happened to them. We've recently had a record-making case in West Virginia where the jury wept upon seeing and hearing a video of my interview of a child who had been abused in a residential care center. It was a very conservative West Virginia county, and they had never given a verdict of that size before. So the legacy has a certain amount of quantitative muscle.
Sure.
Included in it, and the students are fascinated to see that someone who ordinarily they know behind the couch can be on the stand and try to influence social justice and influence foster care systems, influence schools, churches, and often corporations like Uber. This kind of audacity, I think, seems to fit well with Harlem. One has to be audacious to live and work in Harlem while at the same time enjoying a great cultural richness. A diversity, not only of race, but of art, visual art, musical art, spoken art, poetry. It's a wonderful creative cauldron in which to work. But on the side of difficulty and stress, I've seen fit since becoming chairperson, to establish an acute trauma response service. We have acute traumas going on around us in Harlem, a little bit more than most of the country, where domestic violence and murder now are important features of life and death. Recently, a young mother, 9 months pregnant, was shot in the head and killed, and her fetus killed in front of two of her children, as well as a crowd of neighbors. My response was We cannot let this event go without showing that the Harlem Psychoanalytic Institute knows its community and responds to the real life traumas of its community. And so we have started the acute trauma response service with those children and the remaining family members, providing psychotherapy and legal referrals for what is called loss of parental services. The law doesn't acknowledge grief or mourning as compensable, but it acknowledges that parents provide services. And in several states, I have created precedents as an expert, beginning with the Ann Street fire in Manhattan some decades ago, a precedent that children should be compensated and rehabilitated for the loss of parental services. We've done that now in Alaska, in California, as well as in Washington State and New York State. So we're launched now, and I think pretty soon there will be an actual legal service within this psychoanalytic institute where we will provide attorneys for traumatized people who've experienced a wrongfully inflicted trauma, like being locked in an apartment with its fire door unopenable when there's a fire, or in an apartment where the locks don't work and there are known predators around. We've done that in other states. Well, I'm looking forward so much to spending the rest of my adolescent years in some form of developing, cultivating, and expanding that legacy in two ways that I've just mentioned, forensically and in the preschool.
Now, you also, the clinical example you mentioned lends itself to your thinking on PTSD. I didn't know it was something that you were theorizing on until you and I spoke, and I found it fascinating. And can you share it with our listeners, where you are with that?
Yes, I can. I have a view of post-traumatic stress disorder patients, which is literally enhanced by video recorded interviews. In the process of thinking about what I'm seeing as well as what I'm hearing in my interviews of severely traumatized people, especially children, I've come to realize that they're using a language which is probably ancient. It precedes the linguistic spoken language of Homo sapiens. I think what I'm seeing is a form of communication I call iconic memory. It's behavioral, it's signifying, it's communicative. For example, in my series of severely traumatized children, especially, a young girl has been pulled by the hair, smashed against a wall, drowned in a toilet, exposed, and rape attempted on her when she was saved by a passerby. When I interview this girl, who's now six in the video, she looks at me, and while talking, she yanks out a a bundle of her own hair. She sticks her feet up on the desk in a way so that the video camera is snooping down her crotch. She's telling me what happened. We know what happened because the perpetrator was caught and confessed, as well as there being a witness to this terrible event, which occurred in a university restroom near the cafeteria where she, the child, and her mother were having lunch when the child wandered off and was sequestered and assaulted in the restroom. Another child was kidnapped and raped in a trailer while she was on a military picnic. She was a very intelligent child, is still an intelligent child, although less so, I think. And she remembers the smell of the dirty bed on which she was raped, and she gives an account of how terrible it was, yet she managed to escape in a shopping mall when the trailer driver moved her. She ran out a door and sought successfully a police person whom she found, and the police person caught the perpetrator, who confessed. So we know these events are real, but when I'm interviewing her, she tells me that everything in her life is bad. All the memories in her life are bad before this happened, and all the children with whom she engages are bad, take advantage of her, trick her. And she seats a rabbit, a pet rabbit, on her lap, knowing that it will bite her. It bites her in the groin, which is the location in which she had cunnilingus performed on her by this dirty predator. She tells me with her rabbit what happened, and she also tells me through the templates of perception, memory, behavior, and social existence what happened has changed her. It's made her into an icon of the trauma. She cannot think of anything good. She arranges for bad things to happen. She looks quite sexualized when I interview her. She's flirtatious, although 11 years old.
And your understanding of this is different than just people who've been traumatized tend to reenact it over and over again as an attempt, often vain, to master it. You're saying something beyond that.
I am going to spin here a theory,
okay,
of an evolutionary and neurophysiologic and neuroanatomic and psychological and psychoanalytic theory, coalescing all those fields of data into a unifying new theory of post-traumatic stress disorder, in which there is communication to others about what has happened. I look upon this as an impoverishing activity at the expense of the victim, in which the victim altruistically, in an evolutionary sense, altruistically conveys survival valuable information to others in the gene pool. I believe I have so many examples of this on video that I've put them together in an illustrative video called Iconic.
Help me with it, because I'm not quite there yet. I'm not quite getting it. So
you should. I haven't explained it.
Oh, okay. I thought I was supposed to get it. Go ahead. Go for it.
Your failure to be there is because I haven't really started the bus.
All right. I'm ready.
Well, see, these are observations which would seem to be maladaptive. And they're associated with drops of IQ, which many authors have found amongst traumatized children. Mm-hmm. And as Douglas Bremer, I think it's B-R-E-M-M-E-R, has summarized, they're associated with a reduction of the mass of the hippocampus and a number of other cortical areas also. Atrophy after the disorder goes on very long. So one, it's behavioral. Two, it's neurological. Behavior is impoverished, simplified, and repetitive rather than adaptive for the individual. Two, the neurological outcome is impoverishing because and very important emotion and memory processing areas become atrophied. Third, the nature of memory and social perception becomes templated by the information of the traumatic experience. So that memory is recast in the template of the traumatic information. Social perception becomes not only hypervigilant as is part of PTSD, but it tends to be templated in the direction of collecting traumatic information, even from benevolent experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This leads me to regard PTSD as an impoverishing disorder, but it is one which has persisted, apparently, throughout the evolution of our species. And I think it is an altruistic but misguided attempt of nature, considering that we have modern means of communication. And I base my therapy on transforming the behavior into narrative, into verbal narrative. My guided activity workbooks are based upon that endeavor to form artistic and verbalized and mentalized and socially shared narratives in the workbooks. The effort in psychoanalysis, I think, often overlooks that not only are we dealing with what's a repetition compulsion, but the repetition compulsion has meaning, it's communicative, it's rich in many ways, and it's intended to be noticed evolutionarily. It's not covert. It's something which has gone awry. It's like the appendix. It can kill us, but it had a purpose at one time. And if you think in grown-up PTSD, think of a woman who's been raped on an elevator or brutalized on an elevator. Sometimes she has to get on one. When she approaches the elevator, she begins to tremble sweat. Her sweat has a special odor, the odor of fear, as the catecholamines affect the odor of axillary sweat. Others around her know something bad is about to happen. They are alerted. They're made vigilant by the fearful behavior of this woman who might have been in an earlier time attacked by a saber-toothed tiger and trembles when she goes near that part of the jungle. The elevator becomes a place known to be dangerous by those who experience the fear of the victim. Thus, she altruistically has behaved in a way which handicaps her, fatigues her, stops her efficient travel, but it certainly is clear to others. Children do that also.
Gil, it's legacy. I mean, in a sense, that's what we're talking about, all of us, but in this case, you, legacy, to transmit to others, in this case, danger, but also gifts. It's part of our object relatedness that takes us out of our symptomatic self-involved states. Isn't that what you're saying?
Well, I am. Certainly, that's a micro legacy. I think evolution occurred when we were socially very interdependent. We were pack animals. Mm-hmm. We had to communicate non-verbally, rapidly, efficiently, in order to capture the prey on which our survival depended. And I think we had nonverbal means long before we had complicated language. And that's part of my theory. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Speaking of legacy, there, you know, I would enjoy spending time on each of these subjects to take it further and do a deeper dive. But I don't want to run out of time before we can talk about you. And it was your 92nd birthday that you sent this invitation out. And that is a special event, and for many reasons. But it does give us a moment to have you be present and to share with us what life is like for you now, what our field looks like to you. Again, looking back, looking forward, give us a snapshot of yourself.
Well, I feel I'm a very fortunate person. I'm riddled with cancer. I have metastatic carcinoma of the prostate. I have chronic lymphocytic leukemia. My bones show evidence, and my CAT scans show evidence of the progress of the prostatic metastases. I'm really surprised how vigorous my cognitive functions are while my body is weak. I have difficulty walking a mile. I can no longer bike it. A great speed and great length. I have trouble doing anything like a push-up. But my mind seems to go into new frontiers, and my ability to inspire others seems considerable within my seminars. Oh, that's very satisfying.
I imagine.
I see my legacy going on. I'm pleased that I can still write. I can still make a grant application that probably will work. As I see myself, I think I represent a part of psychoanalysis which has been lost. I think it got lost pretty early in the professional career of psychoanalysis. A good source of what I'm thinking about is a book called Driven to Survive by Cordelia Schmidt-Hellerau, who clearly articulated the scientific spirit in which psychoanalysis started. She documented the remarkable audacity Sigmund Freud had, which included an invention of information theory, cybernetics, and semiotics, as well as his discovery of the unconscious. But that audacity has not been well tolerated since. Many original psychoanalytic thinkers have been extruded from our profession. Horney, Jung, Ferenczi. Efforts to broaden psychoanalysis by broadening it from a medical profession have been powerfully resisted. Worst of all, empirical studies that challenge the customary practice are simply intolerable to many scientific bodies. Of course, that's not only true in psychoanalysis. Attempted or actual extrusions of original thinkers is a regular process in many sciences, from astronomy to physics, from Copernicus to Galileo to Newton to Einstein to Pasteur to Semmelweis. But psychoanalytic organizations, in my experience, are particularly deadly to innovation. They function, in my experience, as religious institutions, places to study and disseminate the word, to debate the meaning of words, the meaning of quasi-biblical passages, to create and exclude disciples. They pretend, large psychoanalytic organizations pretend that they are advancing the study of the mind, while they're actually advancing the preservation and study of the word of founders. I saw this early on at the New York Psychoanalytic Institute when a brilliant fellow of mine in my first year was expelled because of his interest in the psychoanalytic value of psychopharmaceuticals. I myself was rebuked as a psychoanalyst for trying Thorazine with a psychotic child. My interest in establishing what could be a measurable means for prevention of mental illness amongst bereaved people was vehemently opposed by a psychoanalyst who headed the residency program. Erna Furman, I remember, vigorously opposed my efforts to persuade her to do IQ testing at the wonderful therapeutic nursery which she headed. But there were even more obvious resistances. In the International Psychoanalytic Association to this day, the most quarrelsome, the loudest voices are those who oppose the work of research, of objective research, especially if it deals with outcome measures that are for example, neurological or neurophysiological or have to do with health of the body. Some of the most important outcome measures in which psychoanalysis excels.
Yeah. You have data on how attending to the mind in the psychoanalytic way has dramatic impact on health. You want to share that with our listeners?
Well, it's not really my data, right. But I take credit for it, and having been approached by Stuart Jeffrey decades ago when he had the impractical idea, as he was an engineer, he had the idea that all children should receive reflective network therapy. Everyone, every child in the United States, I was very flattered by that idea. But I said, you know, it's not going to happen. But I have an idea that I think you could carry out. You could determine whether psychoanalysis preserves life and health. You could study the mortality of psychoanalysts. And Stuart Jeffrey did that, although he wasn't nice enough to credit me for it, the idea. He did a beautiful job. And psychoanalytic organizations should be tooting their horns that they help people live longer. And of course, they...
And that was the outcome of his study?
He published it, I think, in JAPA, I'll get to the reference, by Stuart Jeffrey. Uh-huh. The mortality of psychoanalysts is much greater than that of carefully matched psychiatrists who have not been analyzed, but match their demographic characteristics.
Okay, let me ask you a question, because you are critical of our field.
And I
hear you, but at the same time, you're not as vocal perhaps, but at the same time, you are a great admirer, a great appreciator, better word, a great appreciator of what psychoanalysis can offer. This longevity is one example, but my sense is from you that you love this work. Is that a fair?
Oh, I especially enjoy supervising the treatment of young children and conducting it. And I like establishing a network which is family-like and evolutionarily resembles somewhat the pack that I referred to earlier, that educating and helping the development of very young children in a social network such as reflective network therapy, mm-hmm. is pleasant for me.
In our first conversation back in March, when we were talking about you and your background and all the factors that influence each of us, and you in this case, to do this work, you spoke of your growing up under challenging circumstances, and you spoke of your family Holocaust legacy, which is also, as I listen to you, it seems present in you. That may be presumptuous on my part, but what's your thought?
Well, I think it's more than that. It's true that many of my relatives were wiped out in pogroms and holocausts. I know my grandmother fell silent for many months after learning of 15 members of her family being killed in a pogrom. I'm sure that influenced me, even though I didn't know about it consciously and wasn't told till I was grown. More important and more, I think, powerful in my individual life was having a genetic disorder, which was fatal. I don't know if I got into that when we spoke before.
Just a bit.
I suffer from Lynch syndrome, Lynch, which is an often deadly multiple carcinoma disorder, which killed my father, my paternal grandmother, at least a dozen other members of that branch of the family, has caused great grief to one of my boys and probably another. And I still suffer from it. and have defied death from metastatic carcinoma as long ago as 1978, when I recovered from a metastatic carcinoma of the colon. I think being psychoanalyzed helped me to face the reality of the danger to me. I didn't have to use much denial. I was more adaptive. And to this day, being as ill as I am, I benefit a lot from my third psychoanalysis, which...
You're currently in your third analysis?
I'm currently in my third psychoanalysis, which I think helps me cope with the threats to my life, which are ever present and clearly evident in my medical findings, x-rays and CAT scans are clear evidence of how I'm not going to live a lot longer, but I can make the best of my life. So that's, of course, that's an imperative for me in providing my legacy.
Gil, it's I'm not sure how to thank you for this time you've spent. I hadn't known of your work until our first conversation back a year and a half ago, and I've, as I say, I've been following your work since and speaking to people who have been influenced by your work and have worked with you, and you have made such an impact on so many people from such a deep place in yourself, and I take it that that place is both in your mind and in your heart and in your family legacy. And I'm appreciative. I suspect our listeners will feel the same. And I want to thank you. I don't know how else to say it, but to thank you. Thank you for all you've given, for all you are continuing to give. And when we spoke before, you described your mind being on fire in the best sense. And your thinking is so alive and so vibrant and so creative and so challenging. Ever-present challenging, and that's sort of a leitmotif for you, and it's a delightful one. So I'm grateful for your coming back on the podcast, and perhaps we'll do this again.
Well, thank you so much, Harvey, for helping me keep the fire burning.
My pleasure. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.